I jump into a book. We take a book into our hands and I become everybody everywhere in every era. I become Emma Bovary. It's a very famous expression by Flaubert saying, I'm Emma Bovary. Emma Bovary, c'est moi. I become someone else in a different place, in a different time, in a different body, sometimes in a different sex. And I can become an alien even, and a princess, and a count, and whatever. And then I let go of my defenses. And I delve into my existential struggles, but in this transitional space of literature, which is so unique because, you know, the story of the characters is our story.
Welcome to the IPA Podcast. Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast series introduces the many analysts around the world who, in addition to working in their consulting rooms on the couch, they also work outside their offices. They take their psychoanalytic skills and they bring them to many other venues. They bring them to hospitals, to refugee centers, to business leaders, to childcare clinics, to prisons, just to name a sampling of the many conversations we've had. We've also spoken with analysts again around the world about how they and their patients have been struggling with the COVID crisis. And finally, we speak to a group of analysts who meet the criteria, shall we say, of being the elders of our field. They have been practicing analysis for 40 and 50 years and have special perspectives on this particular period of history and an overview on what the field has been like and how it's evolved over the past half century. I hope you find these conversations engaging and thought-provoking. Please feel free to write comments at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, and thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Merav Groth. Merav has written a book called A Psychoanalytic Perspective on Reading Literature, Reading the Reader. And it's a perfect title for the book, Reading the Reader, because she really immerses us in what the experience of reading can mean to us. Now, many of us, I'm sure, are avid readers, but this will take us to different levels of understanding what that experience is in a way that I found delightful and refreshing. And not only that, it's sort of like when you go on an internet search and you never know where you end up. Reading her book, which has such rich and broad references to the world of literature, stimulated me to read some of the works that she recommended. It's really a treat. Dr. Roth is a clinical psychologist and a training and supervising psychoanalyst at the Israeli Psychoanalytic Society. She is the head of the psychoanalytic psychotherapy program at Sackler School of Medicine in Tel Aviv. And she's a researcher on psychoanalysis and culture, especially literature and trauma. She's the former chair of the interdisciplinary doctoral program in psychoanalysis and the former founder and chair of the postgraduate Klein Studies in the psychoanalytic psychotherapy program. She has edited books on Klein, and she has, this book has recently come out in Rutledge, from Rutledge in 2020, and it also has been translated into Spanish. I hope you enjoy this as I did. Her love of this work is palpable and scholarly, which is a, for something to be both an object of love and an object of scholarship is really a terrific combination. And I enjoyed getting to know Merav, and I hope you do as well. Merav, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
So good to have you here.
Good to be here.
Merav, it is likely the case that many of our listeners are avid readers. And it is likely the case also that as avid readers, and I'm including myself in this, few of us have devoted the thoughtfulness, the research, and the psychoanalytic thinking to the subject of reading as you have. And mm-hmm. to give our listeners just a sample of some of the topics that you cover in your book, and just to remind everybody, your book is called A Psychoanalytic Perspective on Reading Literature, Reading the Reader. So some of the topics you cover are 7 types of identification while reading, resistance to reading, idealizations of the author, reading as a means of transcendence, mutual witnessing. And those are just samples of it. Now, what I want to quickly add, at least somebody feel that this is too dense or too overdone or too intellectual. I can tell you my experience of reading your book and my experience then of reading after reading your book, and that it served not as a burden, not as a cognitive weight on me to try to appreciate all these elements in my experience. It served sort of as a well-timed interpretation that it didn't add weight to my experience. It added lightness to it. It sort of freed me up creatively to engage in the process with new nuance and new depth. And I'm grateful for that.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about some of these subjects. We're not going to be able to get to all of them. For that one, we'll have to read the book. But we'll take up the question of why we read. We're also going to take up the issue of the depressive position, because one of the other things that your book accomplishes is that it offers sort of a tutorial on Kleinian thinking. And some of our listeners, myself included, can always use a reminder of Kleinian thinking, and that is one of your interests. And the book provides a real running commentary on Klein, so we're going to spend some time on that. But I'd like to start us off from the beginning, from your early beginning. You have a fascinating family story about your relationship and your family's relationship to reading and books. So why don't you start us off with that?
Yes, okay. First of all, I'm very grateful for what you said about your experience while reading the book. It was very important for me. I will tell you my story in a second, but it was so important for me that the book will be an experiential reading and not only an intellectual one. And that's why I involved all the literary examples that the reader can read with me to see where did I find what I'm telling about. You know, it was very important for me. So I thank you for what you said. And yes, it's true. I come from a family of writers. My two grandfathers were journalists. My father was a journalist, a publicist. My brother was a journalist. My mother is a writer and a playwright. So I was raised in words. You know, words were running through the blood. And whenever someone was finishing writing a book, we were all reading it. You know, and writing on the side of the book our thoughts about how it's read. And so there I was, quite a young adolescent, asking myself this question without knowing, unconsciously, what is the experience of the reader? And I was exposed to this notion, both on my father's side as a publicist. You know, every Friday he had his column in the newspaper, and I knew that his effort is aimed at transforming the reader's mind. You know, exposing them to new ideas, trying to make them face new ways of thinking. And also from my mother's side, although she's right, she wrote novels, and of course her pure creativity was there, but also she was very much aware of social flaws that are expressed through literature. For instance, the first Zionist pioneers who came to Palestine, they were well written in the local literature, but women were absolutely absent from these stories. And she felt that it's not fair, you know, the women who left the needle and came with bare hands to conquer the land and put pants instead of the nice dresses. So she wrote two historical novels with a woman heroine as the main protagonist, and I knew. Again, it was a thing that happened around me, but I was exposed to this idea. And again, with Northern African women, they were absolutely absent from the literary scene at all. So she wrote another series of detective stories with Lizzie Badichi. She's a well-known and very, very, very loved protagonist here in Israel. She wrote this detective stories with, you know, guess who solves all the mysteries? Of course, this woman that is ignored in the literary scene here. So I was exposed to this idea that that literature changes us, that it transforms our mind. And then afterwards, without thinking about it, I studied psychology, clinical psychology. I became a psychoanalyst, a training psychoanalyst. And then I went to do my PhD. I also studied literature in the university. And then when I came to do my PhD, it occurred to me that what I want to ask now, after all these writers around me and all these questions in the air, is what happens to us when we read books? And that's how I came to this research, and which became, a thing that I'm still exploring to this day.
Let me read something from your book about the subject of transcendence, which takes up the question of why we read. Quote, "The reader uses literature as a way of transcending the circumstances of his existence. The reader ascends on the wings of the text to reach beyond his boundaries and then returns to himself, the same and yet altered. The transcendence occurs in two central planes of the reader's existence, transcendence beyond the boundaries of self-identity and transcendence beyond the boundaries of the human body and death." Close quote. That's certainly jumping into the question of why we read. Tell us more about it. What's your sense of why we turn to literature?
Yes. So I think what you just read is one way to answer it. I think we are exploring our story again and again while we read. There is this term that I named a phenomena that is called the distancing paradox.
Yes.
We are distancing from our existence, from our identity. You know, I was raised in Tel Aviv to these parents, to Holocaust in the background, struggles here. I have my body, I have my sex, I'm a woman, not a man, etc., etc. And then I jump into a book. We take a book into our hands, and I become everybody, everywhere, in every era. I become Emma Bovary. It's a very famous expression by Flaubert, saying, "I'm Emma Bovary. Emma Bovary, c'est moi." I become someone else in a different place, in a different time, in a different body, sometimes in a different sex. And I can become an alien even, and a princess, and a count, and whatever. Mm-hmm. And then I let go of my defenses. And I delve into my existential struggles, but in this transitional space of literature, which is so unique because, you know, the story of the characters is our story. They have the same struggles. They have the same anxieties and hopes and disappointments and dreads. And I read Boccaccio and the Cameroon stories about a pandemic in the 13th century, or the plague by Camus about a pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean COVID-19 in the 21st century. And they teach me so much. I ask myself, how come Dr. Bernard Rieu of Camus' book, where did he find the courage to go and help others and to go through the pandemic with all these human efforts that he could take upon himself. And he is my twin. He is my literary twin. Non-identical twin, which is very important because then he can show me, broaden my limits, you know, broaden my limitations. But he tells me about myself and I don't even know it. And on the other hand, when Emma Bovary is, you know, trying to, with his greedy purchasing and with her betrayals, I want to ask her, what are you doing? Why are you ruining your life? But my fantasies, sometimes my deeds and certainly my fantasies, my unconscious fantasies, they are the same like all the heroes in all the stories because our unconscious, it includes everything. So when I'm asking her, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? I'm asking myself the same question. Or if I'm asking a protagonist, why are you not more forgiving with your parents, with your history, with yourself? I'm asking myself the same question without knowing it. And it's a kind of a great accumulative process. It's not with one book. It's the great diversity of reading that we are going throughout our lives that becomes like a very rich ocean of experiences and human riddles that we are trying to solve again and again and again. Because we are in our, you mentioned the depressive position, because we are in our boundaries, identity and finitude. And we all the time we need to work through our boundaries. And it gives us a very unique opportunity for that.
You make the analogy in the book between what you just described, the essence of the reading experience, and the clinical experience. That there are similarities and differences. Can you say more about that?
Yes, it's quite amazing. It took me time to realize how similar these two situations are. First of all, literary research and psychoanalysis are sister disciplines. They begin at the beginning of the 20th century and they explore each other ever since. Although we had like Shoshana Feldman, the literature and psychoanalysis researcher says that we had master and slave relations with literature, you know, after Freud, with Freud and after Freud, we used to put the protagonists on the sofa and analyze them. Mm-hmm. Always concluded that it's the Oedipal conflict.
Yeah. Isn't it funny how it always ended up there? Yeah, right.
Yes. But that changed a lot ever since the, you know, the postmodern turn, the intertextual turn. So now we are really enriching each other, illuminating each other, the two fields. And then when I thought about it, I thought, well, it's a very similar situation because I can come home from, I don't know, from bringing the kids to school or from groceries or from lecturing in the university. And I have a book that I'm looking forward to meet. And I'm taking this book into my hands. And it's like in a snap that I delve into this situation in the book, and I can come to tears, or I can, you know, be very emotional about it, and I don't want anyone to disturb me. I want to be very concentrated. It needs to be quite a quiet atmosphere in order to read and to really delve into the story. But then, if the phone rings again. In a snap, I can come out of it. I will wipe my tears and I will speak to my mother and I will ask her how she feels. And the unconscious process will continue. It will continue without me. And it's quite the same with the analysis or with the psychotherapy. We come to therapy from whatever we did that day. Someone opens the door to us or we open the door to our patients. And then after 2 minutes, we are in the story. Again, we are dealing with a text, with a hero, with an interpretation of the text. Someone needs to understand the words and to interpret them. And then they read also our story because our interpretations are also stories. So here we are again in the story with the narrator telling the story and with all the existential dramas that are involved in this story. And then after 50 minutes, they will leave the room And in the car, they will already call a friend or do whatever. And again, wipe the tears. And then we are in life. But the unconscious process will continue with them. So it's quite amazing when you think about it, how similar the scene is of both situations.
And the play of the mind, the play between the reader and the writer, the play between the analyst and the analyst, there's a real symmetry.
Yes, the relation, the relations to the text, to the characters, to the writer. Proust had an essay called On Reading, 1905 he wrote it. And he said there that the writer, we want him to tell us everything he knows in order to live our lives better. And it's so similar to what Lacan says, sujet supposé savoir, the subject who is supposed to know. The analyst is the one that the patient wants him to tell all to resolve all the secrets and the riddles and to help him live his life. So we have transference relations. It's one of the gates that I'm opening in the book. We have transference relations towards both the characters, the text, and the writer. Very strong transference relations.
Yes, that's one of the themes that you develop in the book. Yes. Speaking of the people you've referenced in the book, you speak at length, and we should spend some time on it, on a memoir written by Jorge Semprún. The book is called Literature or Life, which I was grateful to have learned about through your book and have since read, and very appreciatively read. It's a memoir of his stay in Buchenwald. He was a Spanish communist political prisoner and therefore was able to survive Buchenwald. And you use him to make some points about the value of literature to help us get through life. Could you want to share a bit of that?
Yes. It's quite an extraordinary book. It's a book, Literature or Life. He wants to tell his story from Buchenwald because he feels that if he doesn't tell the story, he cannot live. But whenever he wants to tell the story, he cannot live because he delves into this horrific time in his life. So, but then he tells the story. And first of all, in his book, you see that he used so many writers during his time in the concentration camp. He took them off his, mind's shelves. He has a library inside himself. He's a very cultural person, and he uses them. There's one place where he says, poets always helped me in the right time with the right text. When reading, I just want to say for a second, how do I read these texts that I'm using, and then I will go into maybe one example from Semprún's book. But beforehand, I will say that what I was looking for is to see what are the unconscious processes that we are using while reading. And this was an obstacle that the reading research is not by no means a new field. It began on the 60s, 70s of the previous century. But there was a constant obstacle. How do we enter the unconscious processes of reading? Because when you ask a reader, what was your experience? Immediately you're in the, in the consciousness zone. Mm-hmm. So, and then I came up with this idea that actually became the methodology of my research, that I found 18 works of literature eventually, and novels and poems and plays and short stories that all involved very strong existential moments, some traumatic, more traumatic, migration, different uncanny states, various situations that has to do with language that also interested me. And in each, I asked the protagonists, I looked for protagonists who were reading in the text. And then when I will the example with Semprun, it will be understood better. But I used a text that inside has a reading experience. And I actually analyzed the reading experiences in the text while thinking that the writer, he didn't know that he is going to participate in a research about reading. He wrote his free associations from his unconscious about from his reading experiences, right, projected into his characters. So that's the nearest I could get into asking what are the unconscious processes, and then that's what I analyzed. That's how I came into the conclusions about what are the unconscious processes. So to take one example, is it okay if I read a small part from Semprun?
Yes, sure, sure. It would be helpful, yeah.
So this is a situation where Semprun is with his friend Halbwachs. He's actually his mentor and friend. Halbwachs was his teacher in the Sorbonne. Both very cultured persons and good friends, and they were in the concentration camp together. And then Halbwachs is dying, and Semprun is near him, and he wants to say something, but he's paralyzed. And now let's see how he spontaneously moves into a literary text in order to help himself transcend this traumatic situation. So I'm reading from Semprun. Then, seized with panic, not knowing whether I might call upon some god to accompany Maurice Halbwachs, yet aware of the need for a prayer, trying to control my voice and pitch it properly despite the lump in my throat, I recited a few lines by Baudelaire. It was the only thing I could think of. And then he quotes, "O death, old captain, it's time, let's weigh anchor." His eyes brightened slightly, as though with astonishment. I continued to recite when I reached the line, "Our hearts, which you know are filled with light." A delicate tremor passed over the lips of Maurice Halbwachs. Dying, he smiled, gazing at me like a brother. So this is, I think, a very strong situation when, in the grip of terror of the imminent death of his mentor, spontaneously, Semprun makes the comparison between what he calls the need for a prayer and Baudelaire's poem. The poetic prayer renews the bond between the two. And Halbwachs' last gaze at Semprun expresses fraternity. This is so strong to show, I think, different aspects that we were already talking about. First of all, the literary twinship. Yes, he found a literary twin with this protagonist who there is Captain Death. Captain Death, it's in Baudelaire's poem. And he's saying farewell, and he gives words he puts words into Semprun's lips that were so paralyzed, and it enabled him to part from his friend, and he also gave him an interpretation. Actually, his literary twin also gives him an interpretation of what he's in now, and what does he need, and what does he want to say, and who are they, him and Halbwachs, and it's such a powerful identification with the literary text and with the literary twin that enables him to transcend this situation where the human limits are so, how do you say it in English? it's not only sad, it's humiliating. It's humiliating. This teacher from the Sorbonne is now about to die with a number on his hand, without a name, because that's the idea. The main idea was to put away any sign of humanity. And then all of a sudden they have Baudelaire between them, and they transcend this situation, both the bodily situation and the spiritual situation. And they remember, if you like, and they remember together who they were and who they will remain in Semprun's memories, and afterwards even, written in his book. Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful moment.
Mm.
Let me ask you about Semprun and your relationship to what he thinks about the role of fiction, because he has some thoughts about fiction versus documentary evidence. He writes,
yes.
Only fiction, he says, not facts, could offer live evidence and bring into being the conditions that will allow the reader's mind to form a connection with the essence of the intolerable human experiences. Semprun believes that only the reader's encounter with the literary story will enable him to imagine and come closer to the evidence about the traumatic reality. All other straightforward documentation or testimonies given in the first person would arouse detachment and unconscious resistance.
Yes.
That's demonstrated in your example, but what's your sense of the role of fiction as contrasted with other forms of literature?
Yes, I think, again, it has to do with the distancing paradox, that when we know that we are reading a... Whenever someone says this is better than that, I'm saying, I don't know. But I think what he means is that when we are reading a documentation of a situation, traumatic or not traumatic, we are using our higher functions, our higher mental functions. We are thinking about it. We know that now we are reading evidence. But when we are reading fiction, we are, as you read from my book beforehand, we are ascending on the wings of literature. Imagination begins to come to play. Playing, what Winnicott taught us so nicely. We are in the intermediate zone, the transitional space. We can imagine. We need to imagine. We don't even think about it, but we need to imagine. Sometimes people ask me, what do you think about the difference between books and TV series that are so popular today? And I say, in TV series, I don't need to imagine the heights of the people and the tone of their voice. When we are in fiction, we are imagining a lot. We are working, we are processing in so many layers and levels of our imagination and of our psychic reality, internal world. We are projecting into it a lot from our own object relations, internal object relations. And documentation is, I'm listening to someone who is telling me his story, and I can remain detached, and I learn a lot. But it's a very different ground. It's a very different psychic process. And that's why I think Semprun, and we can see it also in his book, that he's using a lot of fiction, but he's also, it's interesting, he's also using philosophy as fiction. I don't know, people can read philosophy as an intellectual text, but whenever he's reading, I think he plays with the text. So there is this very strong place in the book that he says we need a Dostoevsky in order to tell the story of the Holocaust, which is, it's paradoxical. Why do we need, how come Dostoevsky is a part of it? But it's because their story is our story.
Can you give that other example from his book that you use in your book when he's interviewing a visitor, as it were, from Auschwitz, who tells him a story that is too disturbing for him to tolerate, and he turns to literature to tolerate it?
Well, there are quite a few. I think maybe one quite amazing place, and this has to do with another phenomenon that I found quite inspiring, actually, which is the ethical standing that is processed and developed, I think, through reading. There is a very small moment. He runs away from the camp with a friend, and they have guns on them. And on the other side of the bank of a river, they see a German soldier, a Nazi, and they point their guns at him. But then this guy begins to sing La Paloma. And Semprún says that the moment he sang La Paloma, not only that he could not shoot him, he says that he became innocent. It had suddenly made him innocent. And this is a very, very strong moment. Why? What? This is a Nazi soldier. Their families are murdered. They suffer for days and weeks and months in the concentration camp. They have this moment that when they can revenge and, you know, and take back their dignity by saying we are controlling our lives by killing the one who kills us. And then it all vanishes because this guy sang La Paloma, because he knew a poem, he knew to recite, he knew to sing.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you think about it, again, when you analyze the psychological process here, when the guy sings La Paloma, he is widened, again, the depressive position. You cannot use the paranoid schizoid position anymore. The split between an enemy and a good and an innocent person, between a Nazi and a normal guy, between good and bad, black and white, them and us, him and me, all these splitting defensive mechanisms that aid us during a stress. He cannot use it again. He cannot use it anymore because the scope is widened, and this guy was a baby or a young child. His mother taught him a poem, taught him a song. He has a history. He has a family. He has, some relation to culture.
His humanity.
And the minute this depressive position is into yes. into play, then he cannot think of him as someone he needs to shoot. He can only begin to mourn, and that's another phenomenon that I'm tracing in the book, the art of mourning. He can begin to mourn the fact that we are in this terrible, terrible situation, that people went so wrong into the wrong route, but this is already a different area.
And perhaps we'll leave it hanging for the audience to read the book to find the end of that story. a little bit of a teaser, what he did in the face of encountering the Nazis' humanity.
Yes.
You mention again the depressive position, and that is an important theme that runs through your thinking in the book. Can you tell us more about how you see that as an essential part of the reading experience?
Yes. When we are facing our lives from near, we are using both kinds of defenses, right? The paranoid schizoid defenses that are more primitive. We split the world into good and bad and me and them. We project on the other many things. It was interesting. Once Steiner was interviewed because one of his books, John Steiner, one of his books was translated into Hebrew. And there was an interview with him in the Psychoanalytic Society in Israel, in Jerusalem. And I don't remember exactly how, but he said that the enemy is always someone that you projected upon or into your murderousness, your hatred, your envy, your limitations. And I think that is very true, because the truth is always a wider and more complex, the human truth, this is the human nature, is always a complexity of traits and tendencies. So in our lives, when we are threatened, when we are intimidated, we use primitive defenses, omnipotence, projection, projective identification, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, the distancing paradox, when I'm reading about someone that in the book we consciously identify with the good guy, but unconsciously we also identify with the villain, because we have everything inside us. And then we have an option to begin and see the other sides of each picture. You know, in history, it's quite amazing. Even here in Israel, there is a book by a writer named Dorit Rabinyan. And she wrote a book, a very beautiful book named, I think it's in English, it's called Two Sides of a River, or something like that, about a woman, an Israeli woman, who meets a Palestinian in New York. He's a painter, and they fall in love. And they have a very beautiful love story, but also very painful because of all, you know, the struggles here between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And it's a very touching story. And then here in Israel, the government, which, allow me to say, thank goodness, it's not the same government as now, the government decided that it's forbidden to teach in high school this book. So first of all, you think, wow, this is really, you know, a great recognition about literature's influence on people, right?
Right, sure.
And we have other examples from history. Jan Werther of Goethe, that was forbidden to be published because people committed suicide when reading this young boy's love story and broken heart and suicidal tendencies. And also Madame Bovary, that was forbidden because it was the first time that in literature they told a story about infidelity. And he was brought into court. But Flaubert was brought into court. There is, I will say in brackets, a short story, and then I will come back to what you asked me. Because it's such a cinematic or literary scene that he's standing in court and he's reading out loud the scene that is allegedly the right to decide that they will not publish the book. And it's the scene is when they're going in the carriage, Emma Bovary is going with her lover in the carriage, and they're, you know, having the time of their lives around Rouen. The carriage is going up and down and up and down and this and that. It's a few pages that he's reading in court. But then he tells them, listen, in the story, the curtains are closed. The curtains of the carriage are closed. So the only thing that was that happened here was your imagination. It's the reader's imagination. It's not in the book. I did not mention a part of a body even. And then they decide that he can continue to publish the book, and it becomes a bestseller. So we have in history these tremendously amazing stories about the influence of literature, and Chapman that is killing John Lennon because of Catcher in the Rye, and I can continue. Anyway, going back to Dorit Rabinyan, what was the government so afraid of? It was afraid that when I will read the book, I will, God forbid, think that the Palestinians are having their dinner on Friday, just as me, and they're taking the videos of their nephews and their grandchildren, and they're looking out the window, and they're thinking where they're going to, because this is told in the story. They're talking about it between them. So it will broaden my you know, my mental scope. It will broaden my scene of the other. My ethical standing is developing while I'm reading. And this is a depressive position and a depressive, victory.
Orientation?
I don't know. That's a good word. Sorry?
Yeah, I was going to say it's an orientation, the depressive position orientation, where the humanity of the other is embraced.
It's a depressive achievement. That's what I was looking for. It's a depressive achievement to see the other in his otherness, and to accept the fact that I'm like him, and the differences don't mean that he's the bad guy and I'm the good guy. No, It means that we have different cultures, we have maybe different aims, maybe even a very big conflict. But he's a person like me. So that small situation from Semprun's book is an example to this, to the fact that when I'm reading, I'm exposed to the internal world of others. And again, in accumulating a process during reading throughout our lives, that really makes me it allows us a psychic development and an ethical development, which is very deep, I think.
I'll share with you a parallel process you're talking about with the experience of immersing yourself in literature, how it provides broadening for oneself. Well, as I'm listening to you to describe the various glimpses of literature, and you both have a knowledge of these glimpses of literature and an obvious delight in the melodies and the notes and the tones of the literature, I'm smiling. I'm smiling because I'm enjoying your erudition. I'm taking in your enthusiasm and your immersion in it. And there's a parallel process for me in engaging with you as you're describing your engagement in literature. And I hope our listeners will share in that as well. Rob, you have a poem that you thought might be useful in this conversation.
The poem, yes. First of all, because I have a friend here who tells me that, but when you're speaking about literature, you forget to mention how amusing it is sometimes. And how. So there is an ironic, beautiful poem by the American poet Mark Strand, the Jewish American poet Mark Strand, called Eating Poetry, named Eating Poetry. And I think it following what you just said about my my enjoyment of this this field, I think, well, it will speak to itself. I will read it?
Yes.
Okay, Eating Poetry. Ink runs from the corners of my mouth. There is no happiness like mine. I have been eating poetry. The librarian does not believe what she sees. Her eyes are sad, and she walks with her hands in her dress. The poems are gone. The light is dim. The dogs are on the basement stairs and coming up. Their eyeballs roll. Their blonde legs burn like brush. The poor librarian begins to stamp her feet and weep. She does not understand. When I get on my knees and lick her hand, she screams, "I am a new man." I snarl at her and bark. I romp with joy in the bookish dark.
That was delightful. Thank you. And it does capture the heart of your love of reading and how it's so much a part of you, as you say, from very early on in your life. I'm assuming we will be reading more of you, that you will be continuing your research on literature.
Yes.
The book is called, again, A Psychoanalytic Perspective on Reading Literature, Reading the Reader. Mirav, thank you for sharing. And thank you for your work, of course, but thank you for sharing it with us in such an engaging way that gives us a feel for you, for the literature. As I said, after reading your book, I went out and bought the Semprun book, and it grows from there, as I'm sure it will for many listeners. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Harvey. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you for this conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.